All right, let's get this thing rolling here. Let me see. Okay, there we go. Okay, tonight as we start with lesson four, we're going to be looking at another one on the Bible tonight, and a very important one. And if you have any questions as we're working our way through, please ask the questions, because there's a lot of good things we're going to be discussing here tonight as we work through this. But as we do, let's start out with a little bit of review. Last week we talked about the Bible canon, the canonicity of the Bible, and we said that the canonization has to do with the determining which books deserve the designation of Scripture, ought to be included in the Bible. So when they determine that, which ones are supposed to be and which ones are not, that's a very important thing. Every God-inspired book was part of the biblical canon the moment God had it written. He knew what he inspired. All right, so God knew what he inspired. Wasn't it any mystery to him? Man had to figure it out, but God knew. Okay, so that's a good thing for us to remember. The main criteria for identifying the canonical Bibles were, all right, so let's just try to think of this before I bring it up on the screen. What were some of the things that were criteria? What did they use to determine whether it was biblical, I mean, what was Scripture and what was not Scripture? Remember any of them? Peter? Okay. Yeah, so it was written by someone who was a prophet or an associate of them. I thought it was one of them. All right, so that was a big one there for your first one. And then second, it claimed to be the Word of God. All right, so that's important. I mean, that's an easy one. If it says, thus saith the Lord, it's pretty obvious that it came from God, and it was something for us to remember. It was accepted by the believers. All right, so the believers throughout the Old Testament or the New Testament, during those times, if they said, no, there's just something wrong with this. This isn't right. I don't feel like this is really what God... And then, that wasn't one that they considered, but the ones that they really felt like were definitely biblical were the ones that were helpful. The Apocrypha, all right, those books stuck in the middle of the Catholic Bible, the Apocrypha is not part of God's Word. All right, it's an important force to remember that, and I don't think any of us question that, but it's good to have it tucked into our mind about that. Now, the New Testament canon was identified about 363, and there's variations of ideas on this, all right? But that's when seems to be, that was pretty much settled by then. So that's 363 years after the birth of Christ, or thereabouts, okay? And then God is not revealing new truth today to men. The Bible is complete. And that's an important thing for us to grasp. And there's a lot of people today that don't believe that. Right? A lot of people believe that, that they're still getting revelations from God, they're still getting information from God, and I don't know anybody that's bold enough to open their Bible and start writing them down on the back leaves of their Bible. But at the same time, they say they're getting them from God. And if they really are, then they're kind of on a par with the Bible. All right, so that brings us tonight to the Bible's preservation. How was the Bible preserved? Okay, and originally, the Bible was written in what three languages? Okay.
Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek.
Okay. Mainly Hebrew in the Old Testament, just a little tiny bit of Aramaic. And what was the Aramaic? What language was that?
It's kind of like the main Middle Eastern language for most of the...
Why would have the Bible been written, a little bit of it written in that?
Because many of the, I suppose, the scholarly types of people at that time...
There was a specific reason. There was a specific reason. Jared?
No, I was going to say...
Peter? Well, you may have, but that was the Old Testament that was before the time of Christ. All right, so what? There's a reason, all right? Aramaic...
The people who wrote it only spoke that language?
Well, I think they spoke more than that. But the Aramaic was one of the main languages in Babylon.
Oh.
Okay, it was a Chaldean language.
Yeah.
All right, so because of the Babylonian captivity, some of the Bible, Daniel, and there's a bits of Daniel and a couple of the places that have a little bit of that in it, and that's probably why, because they came from there. All right, Johnny?
I know this is a different topic, but it's just interesting to note that they found in Babylonian, like, stone tablets and stuff, and stories that are extremely similar to some Bible stories. And, I mean, it's interesting that the Babylonians would have probably heard a lot of the Jewish stories as these people came in and kind of adapted it, even though it's not inspired and
right.
Their
No question. Okay, so we got the three languages, Hebrew, a little bit of Aramaic, And then the whole New Testament was written in Greek. Right? And that was significant because the Greeks were in control of the world at that time, so it allowed the New Testament to spread very rapidly. And Greek is a very fascinating language and a very good one for the New Testament to be written in. Now, the original manuscripts. The original Bible manuscripts are called autographs. Right? So autographs. Good thing to keep in your mind. Moses began writing the Old Testament about 1400 B.C., and Malachi completed about 400 B.C. All right, so there's a time span there. And then the Old Testament is nearly all Hebrew, parts of Daniel and Ezra. Remember, Daniel and Ezra, both of them had been in where? They'd been over in Babylon. Okay, so that's why there was that Chaldee influence there with the Aramaic. And then the New Testament was written in the first century entirely in Greek. Okay, now early writing paper was papyrus. That was based on or made from some plants, papyrus plants in from Egypt, and it grew along the Nile River, and they would take them and weave them and beat them and smash them and wet them and, until they could get it down into a paper type of thing. A lot of work to do that. But then later on, they started using parchment, which was skins. All right, so these are the two things. Now, neither of them are very long-lasting. And that's significant because when we think about the manuscripts and the preservation of these manuscripts, if they were paper made from reeds or paper even made from skins, they're not going to last all that long. There's going to be a limited lifespan to them. Whereas paper today, you know, taken care of properly, can last for a long, long, long time.
Yeah. It's interesting. Even when they do find really old parchments, like a lot of people hear about the Dead Sea Scrolls, they think like these scrolls. But what people don't realize is when they mean scrolls, they mean like clay jars with tiny little fragments of paper that have to be meticulously put together over many years.
Yeah, they're not actual. The paper disintegrated.
A lot of people don't think that scrolls are picture like an actual
layer. Yeah, well, they disintegrated by then, you're right. Okay? So now the copies of the originals. All right, so they had the originals. The originals were the ones that got inspired. And now the copies of the originals, copying the Bible began early in history. And let's just look up some of these verses here. All right? So if you got a Bible, you can help me out here. We'll just look up some of these and won't spend a long time deliberating on them, but just looking them up and see some of this. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 18. Deuteronomy 17, 18. Okay. Deuteronomy 17, verse 18. Somebody want to read that when they find it? Deuteronomy 17.
And it shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out. Of that which is before the priests, the Levites.
Okay, so the king was supposed to write himself a copy of the Bible. He was supposed to have his own personal copy of the Bible. Now, that's, you know, to us today, we think, well, of course, everybody should have their own copy of the Bible. But in those days, when you had to handwrite it, that was a major job. Like, can you imagine handwriting the first five books of the Bible? That would take you some time. And to be so meticulous and careful that you didn't make any mistakes, that would take even more time. So it was a lot of work doing that. The next one is in Joshua, chapter 8 and verse 32. Someone like to read that one? Joshua 8, 32. Garrett, you volunteering?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Joshua 8, 32.
And he wrote there upon these stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he wrote in the presence of the children of Israel.
Okay, so here again, they made a copy of the commandments and that was given to Moses. And so this process of making copies began early, way back in the early parts of the Bible. Now, about 200 B.C., men translated the Old Testament Hebrew and Aramaic into the Greek called the Septuagint or the LXX. All right? We've talked about that a little bit in the past, but it's good for us to have that cemented in our mind. The Greek translation of the Old Testament was called the Septuagint, or the LXX, right, the 70. Right? And then the Masorite scribes. Masorite scribes were scribes during the early period there, of the late period of the Old Testament, early New Testament. The Masoretic scribes used extreme care in copying the Hebrew Old Testament, beginning beginning about the first century A.D. All right, so in the first century, shortly after the time of Christ, or during, you know, right after the time of Christ, the Masoretic scribes were working to copy the Hebrew Old Testament. Very meticulous job. You know, even you think about it today, it's an extremely big task to take the whole Bible, even in English, and get it all typeset and ready to go to a printer of that sort. That's a major, major job. But doing it without all the modern equipment that we have and without the computers and without the nice paper and without the nice pens and using a chicken feather with dipped in ink and, you know, being careful, you know, I mean, that's going to take you a while.
Another point. In those days, they didn't have verses like yes. 1, 2, 3, 4, so you had no idea what you were up to.
Yeah, you're right. The Bible wasn't divided into verses. It wasn't divided into chapters. Wasn't divided into verses. Yeah. So you had a long flowing text, and to you know you stop to take a break, and you come back and think, where was I?
Where was I?
All right. So it was a very major task, and it was very time consuming. Now the New Testament manuscripts were shared by the churches. Colossians chapter 4, verse 16. Paul here mentions that he wanted one of the other churches to read the same book, Colossians chapter 4 and verse number 16. Colossians 4, verse 16. Anyone want to try that one? Colossians 4, 16. Go ahead, Indica.
Okay. And when this epistle is read among you, cause that it be read also in the church of the Laodiceans, and that ye likewise read the epistle from the Laodicean.
Okay, so Paul said, I've written to the Laodicea, and I want you to share your book with them, and I want you to read the book that I sent to them. All right, so they were sharing copies of the scriptures that they had there in the New Testament. Now, Jerome translated the Bible into Latin in about 382 A.D. and called it the Vulgate. Very well-known translation, the Latin Vulgate, and it was, from what I understand, a fairly good translation, if you can read Latin, but it was one of the first translations into one of those other languages.
Things usually lose a lot in translation, and if it's been translated that much from one language into another one, and then into another one.
Yes. See, that you just brought up an excellent point here, Inika. And Peter and Ruth could give us more information on this because they've been working with translation. But any time you translate from one language to another language, you know, like if someone was to translate the Bible today into English, the worst thing you could do is to use another English translation as your base.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing you could do. Because, or if you're translating even into a tribal language, you know, like in Papua New Guinea or something like that, I know some people that have tried to translate the King James English Bible into a tribal language, and that's not the way to go about doing it. All right, that's not a good idea, because every time you translate, you lose things in the translation. You can't help it. You'd have to write.
Isn't the exact word.
Yes,
so
it makes it difficult. All right, so that's good. Now, no copy or translation of the Bible is inspired. Only the originals were inspired. Now, that's an important thing for us to remember, because we can get ourselves in a lot of trouble if we think otherwise. All right, we need to make sure we have accurate translations. We need to have a carefully done translation. But to say that it is inspired means that God actually breathed on them as they were writing down the words in English or in French or in Japanese or whatever it was. And God didn't do that. Okay? So it's important for us to keep that in mind. Now, surviving manuscripts. This is an important one. And I say before we even look at the screen here, there are differences of opinions on how many manuscripts are there. And some of the information I have either is outdated or there's others that have added their thoughts to it. I don't know, but the information I have seems to be pretty accurate. Okay, all original manuscripts are gone now, except only copies exist. That's an important one. All right. So all of the major, when Paul wrote on those scrolls and in the book of Ephesians or Romans, or those are all gone. All right, and all the Old Testament scrolls are all gone. Right? There's nothing left of the originals. They're gone. But there are copies that exist, and that's important. The total number of, now most of this that we're talking about here is New Testament information. The Old Testament is pretty much solid. There's not a lot of debate in the Old Testament. But the total number of manuscripts of the whole or part of the New Testament found so far is 5,488. All right, and that's according to the Trinitarian Bible Society. Okay, and I think that's pretty accurate. They may have found some more since then, because you'll see some of the other information I give you indicates that there's probably some more. So I don't know. But these manuscripts are divided into four categories. The first one is the papyri. There's 96 copies made from papyrus plant, nearly all fragments. All right, so remember the papyrus was all the reeds that they beat together and made their paper out of it. There's fragments of that. There's 96 copies of little fragments. All right, and then the unctuals, there's 299 copies of these, all of them in uppercase. All right, so they're all capital letters, and they were written in about the 4th century or later. All right, so those are the unctuals. And then there's the minuscules. There's 2,812 of those, and they're all in lowercase. All right, so there wasn't any capitals, straight lowercase. And, I don't know about you, but when I get a letter from somebody that sends me an email and it's all in uppercase, I think, oh, I don't want to read this. It bugs me. All right, and if it was all in lowercase, that'd irritate you too. So that's the way these were, and yet that's the way they wrote at that time. All right, and then there's lectionaries. The lectionaries there's 2,281 copies of them. They're portions of the Bible, portions used in public church reading, right, in the 6th century and later. So these would be just little pieces that maybe, they had a chapter of Romans or something, and they pass it around to the churches, and half a chapter of Ephesians, but that's what these are. They're called lectionaries that they were passing around in the churches during the 6th century and after that. Okay? So any questions about this? This is a good thing for us to get around in our head, the original manuscripts. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
Well, all of those from the Trinitarian Bible Society?
Yes, all this was from the Trinitarian Bible Society. So if you went on their website, Trinitarian Bibles, tbsbibles.org, you'd get this kind of information. They have a lot of good articles on there. And they seem to be pretty good articles, and they defend the King James, and they're trying to do what's right, and they're not trying to exaggerate things, I don't think. This next article, you'll see here, the amounts are a little different. This came from a Wikipedia, so who knows really who put this together. But parts of the New Testament have been preserved in more manuscripts than any other ancient work. There are over 5,800, all right, so they got about 350 more, according to this one, complete fragments of the Greek manuscripts, 10,000 Latin manuscripts, and 9,300 manuscripts in various other ancient languages, such as Syriac, Slavic, Gothic, Ethiopic, there it is, thank you, Ethiopic, and the Coptic, and the Armenian. All right, so all these little fragments of pieces. So these are the information that maybe is later than what the other information was, or else it just varies a little bit. But it's pretty much the same, all right? We're not talking about a great deal of difference. Now, there's two types of surviving manuscripts, and this really is the key and the foundation of a lot of the information we're going to be looking at here, is these two types. All right, so it's good that we see that the first type is a Byzantine type manuscript, all right? The Byzantine text type. Right, this name comes from Byzantine area, mainly Syria and Turkey and Greece. All right, so you picture in your mind Syria, Turkey, and Greece, and it was that area where Paul preached. Basically, the area where Paul ministered was the Byzantine area, and that was one of the hubs of Christianity. All right, so Paul started those churches there. There was a lot of Christian activity there. And that was really, during the first few centuries, was really the central hub of Christianity. This is the Byzantine area. And so it's called the majority text, right? The Byzantine text or the majority text are used interchangeably. So if you hear that term, Byzantine or majority, they are interchangeable. And about 90% of the surviving manuscripts support the Byzantine text. So there's about 5,000 that support that of the 5,480. Right, so approximately 90% of all the manuscripts they found go along with the Byzantine text. Christianity is had its strongest roots in the Byzantine area. I just mentioned that a moment ago with Paul's churches there. And it was the center of Christianity after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And Constantinople was the center of Greek-speaking world. All right, so all this is right there in Turkey and the surrounding areas, what we now know as Turkey. Okay? Yes, sir?
In fact, Constantinople used to be called Byzantium. Which is now called Istanbul.
Istanbul used to be called Constantinople after Emperor
Constantine. Before that, it was called Byzantium, which is why the area was called Byzantine.
Okay. Good. Okay. Well, good. Appreciate that input. All right. So, gives you a little bit of an idea of the area there and where all this was taking place. Now, for 1,800 years, the Byzantine text type was the standard Greek text. Now, I think that's very important for us to understand, and I don't think there's a lot much debate over that. For 1,800 years, for 1,800 years, the Byzantine type text was the standard Bible Greek text. All right, now, the second surviving kind is called the Alexandrian text type. All right, the Alexandrian type. Now, it comes from Alexandria in Egypt, right at the top of Egypt, the city of Alexandria. And there was also Christians along in there. And it was also called the Critical Text or the Westcott and Hort Text. So those three names, Alexandrian, Critical, and Westcott and Hort, all refer to the same text. All right. And this minority text is based on less than 10% of the surviving manuscripts. So you got the 90% to support the Byzantine. You got less than 10% to support the Alexandrian or the Critical Text. John?
The way I understand, like, the people who use the 10% text, they will overrule these ones who are older, so therefore...
Well, we'll get into that. Okay. All right. So, the two chief Alexandrian manuscripts are the Sinaiticus, or also called Elf, found in a rubbish bin in the St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai in 1844, and the Vaticanus, or the B text, found in the Vatican Library in Rome and studied in 1867. All right, so these are the two manuscripts that are the main basis for the Alexandrian text. There's others, but these two are the main ones, and this is the ones that you'll hear regularly, the Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. All right, now, as we look at these, the Sinaiticus and Vaticanus disagree with each other about 3,000 times in the Gospels alone. And they differ from the Byzantine text over 6,000 places. Right? So there's a lot of difficulty, even between themselves, as to what the text actually said. There's a lot of differences. Now, granted, I'm not saying major differences all the time. Sometimes it might have been a letter. Sometimes it might have been a plural or a singular type of thing. But other times it was pretty significant, as we'll see. Right? They leave out portions of over 200 verses in the New Testament. And 17 verses completely missing from the New Testament. And a few of them just noted here for your information. And you'll find, you know, on our back table at church there, I have a pamphlet that I put out there, Is Your Bible Full of Holes? Or something like that. I can't remember exactly. But that's what it highlights. It, all those places where there's things missing, you can look it up for yourself. There's things missing in the text because it comes from the Vaticanus and Sinaiticus in the critical text. Okay, so that's where it comes from. In 1881, two Greek scholars, B.F. Westcott and F.J.A. Hort, popularized the Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, claiming that they were the oldest surviving manuscripts and therefore the best. Okay, so I'm not here to dispute their age. They were old. I'm not going to deny that. They were old. But just because they're old doesn't mean they're best. All right? There's a lot of things that are old that aren't the best. All right? And one thing, you know, in my library, if I looked at the books that I have in my library, I got some of them that are quite old. And I've got some others that aren't very old, but some of the ones that aren't very old are ones that I use all the time, and they're getting beat up and not looking so sharp. But the ones that are, I never use because they're just not very helpful, they may be very old, but they just look like almost brand new because they just sit there and never get used. And that is so true in other ways, and that, I believe, is one of the reasons we see this. Their survival age is most likely because they were not used and were kept in a dry climate in Egypt. Why now? That dry climate has a big factor involved. You take this kind of parchment or skins and put it in a humid climate where there's winters and summers and change and all that kind of stuff, and it's going to disintegrate much faster than one that's in a dry climate where it's hot and dry and deserty all the time. Right? And so that's one of the reasons why there would be a difference in the longevity of the Byzantine text and the critical text. Plus, the Byzantine texts were constantly being used. The Christians there were using them and using them and using them and copying them and using them and copying them because it was a very big area of Christianity, whereas in Egypt, it was not as much of that. It wasn't the hub of Christianity as it was there in the other region. All right, now, translating manuscripts. The Byzantine Greek text was a standard for before 1881. Right, so if you were going to translate the Bible before 1881, you would have used the Byzantine text because that's the text that they had. That was the one that was everybody used. And the Catholic Church prevented translation work for many years. It's sad. But through the Dark Ages, from 400 until 1600, the Catholic Church did everything they could to quash the Bible. They didn't want the common people to read the Bible because if the common people read the Bible, they would discover things that they didn't want them to discover. Right? So they said that in order to read the Bible and understand the Bible, you had to be a priest or, you know, one of their cardinals or somebody else in the hierarchy that could translate it and understand it correctly, because the average person, you weren't supposed to be able to read it. And so they really did their best to make it illegal and destroy as much of it as they could. Now, Wycliffe translated the Vulgate into English in 1384. All right, so here, you know, I don't know, and I didn't take the time to look whether Wycliffe also used Greek or not, but apparently the Vulgate was his main source. Right? And as Inika already pointed out, and we've already discussed, that's not a good option unless that's the only thing he had. All right, so it could be that Wycliffe didn't have any access to anything else, and all he had was the Vulgate. Well, fine. He was putting in English. He was trying to make it available for the farmers so that the common people could read the Bible, and that was a commendable thing to do. And the common people couldn't read Latin, so there was an opportunity for them to get that. Now, a standard Byzantine Greek text was compiled by Erasmus in 1516, and it was called the Textus Receptus. All right, the Textus Receptus. Now, the term Textus Receptus doesn't refer to one particular Greek manuscript, but it refers to kind of a family, like in a sense, because there's several different versions of the Textus Receptus. Other Textus Receptus texts were compiled by Stephanus in 1550, and I personally think that the Stephanus text is probably one of the most accurate of all of them, from what I can sense in my studies. And the Beza text in 1565, and in 1633, and then the Scrivener text in 1894. Okay? Now, these are all considered the Textus Receptus, but because they're all the same family, but they would all have slightly different variations. Okay? Any questions about that before we move?
Sounds very involved.
Well, it can be very involved. It's very interesting study, you know, and going back to the Greek, I thoroughly enjoy studying Greek, and you know, I use it virtually every day in my studies and even in my own personal devotions, because I really, really enjoy that. But not everybody's got the full ability to do that. But the neat thing is today that anybody that's got a phone that has the Strong's numbers in it, you can, in a sense, use the Greek in English. All right? And it's a very great, helpful tool, because you'll be able to then pick up variances of of the way words are used. It's extremely helpful to dig into it and to research. And I mean, for example, I use the Hebrew Old Testament, and I don't know any Hebrew. I don't know any Hebrew at all, but I use those same tools in the Hebrew Old Testament, and I can gain a lot from just looking at that. And so there's lots of things you can do by doing that if you'll just dig into it. Yes, ma'am.
It's just a guess. I'm not sure, but I think Wycliffe probably would have had access to more than the Vulgate because he was initially impressed in the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes.
And they did have libraries and things that they could access.
I would expect that he did, but because I didn't actually look it up to see for positive, I'm not going to make any comment on that, but I would suspect that he probably did have something more. But you remember, too, that when Wycliffe was translating this, that was not a popular thing to do. I mean, he was working against the Catholic Church in doing that. And it was still during the Dark Ages when he was doing that. And so it was against the law to do what he was doing. And so that would make it more difficult to get access to volumes of information. I mean, not just everybody had a copy. I mean, this is 1384. Wasn't it in the 1400s when Gutenberg made his press? Okay, so that would be before the press then. So that means everything in Wycliffe's day was handwritten. So to get a hold of a handwritten copy of the Greek New Testament would have been a very, very valuable thing to get a hold of. Okay, John Reed?
Actually, an interesting fact that a lot of people don't know about, and there's been a lot of documentaries and stuff made about it. But even till this day, the Vatican has one of the oldest, longest running libraries in the world. Till this day, it's still very off limits. Like, they still have what some people say as much as hundreds of thousands, some people say millions, of not just copies of religious texts and stuff that they've taken and confiscated and stored away, but also government documents, everything where they have control. There's so much stuff that they, till this day, they still keep down there. You can only imagine what they've confiscated from the Christians over the years.
Yeah. Still don't have to. Who knows? Okay, so this is a little bit about the Greek Byzantine text. Now, Tyndale translated the English New Testament from the Byzantine Greek text in 1526. The Coverdale Bible was another one. The Coverdale Bible in 1535 was the first entire Bible in English from the Greek. All right, so the Coverdale Bible was a very significant translation. All right, the Great Bible, this was one that was really, you know, very popular Bible for many years, done in 1539. Okay, then the Bishop's Bible, 1568, and then the King James Bible was done in 1611. All right, so it gives you a little bit of an idea of some of the early Bibles that were put together and some of the conflict that was behind them. There was political things that were involved in it. Even the King James Bible, there was political issues that, you know, why they... For example, one of the words that is a political term in the King James Bible is baptism. Because the Greek word is immersion. And baptize is a transliteration. The Greek word is baptizo. And so they made up a new word called baptize based on baptizo. And baptize meant nothing, because there was nothing behind it. And so it was a word that you could use for anything you wanted. If you wanted to make it baby baptism, that's okay. If you wanted to make it some other baptism, that's okay. But if they would have translated immersion, that would have been a politically incorrect, because then you're offending the Catholics, you're offending all the baby baptizers. Right? So that's one example of a word that was transliterated in a political reason. Jared?
Just a word, the only word that I know, there might be more, but some words that we use today, some words that the Bible used that we don't use today, like dragon, for example. We call that dinosaur today. In the Bible, it just refers to it as a dragon. Just little words like that we don't use. I mean, we use the word dragon. But...
Well, see, in that case, you know, they were using, I mean, they knew what dragons were. And that's all that they knew what they were called. And so dinosaurs weren't even called dinosaurs until much, much, much later than that. So they couldn't have used another word like that. So there are words like that have been sort of become obsolete. No question about that. But that doesn't make them inaccurate. It simply means that the language has changed. What I was just pointing out with the word baptize and baptizo was, and even the word church. Church is another one of those words. It comes from the word ecclesia, which means an assembly. And yet they've translated it church, which you can make it whatever you want, instead of calling it an assembly. That was not a transliteration, but it is another one of those kind of examples. Okay, and the King James is the most accurate popular English translation from the TR text. I say the most accurate popular translation because there's other translations from the TR text, but that's the most popular one. For study, some other Bible softwares contain the King James 2000, and that is actually a pretty helpful translation. It's more of a modification of the King James. They've basically just taken the obsolete words and fixed the obsolete words. But it's pretty good. The MKJV is one done by a fellow named Green, and that is more of a literal translation. And I use that for comparisons in my study. Also, the Young's Literal Translation is another very literal translation of the Bible, which is very helpful for comparison. And neither of them are all that readable as far as just using as a readable text, but they are very literal, and they help you to see things. You know, what I often do in my studies when I'm going through a verse, I find a verse that I'm focusing on, and I'll look it up in these other variations, and if I see something that stands out and says, oh, wow, look, they changed. Wow, that's quite a bit different than this was, then I start digging. Say, all right, why was there something different there? And then I dig up and look at all the words and all the things around it. And it's a quick way of just kind of getting to the issues quickly. By looking at some of the other translations and see what they did with some of the words to see if there's a difference. If they're all basically the same, then I just kind of move on and say, yeah, they're all, you know, we got a pretty accurate one. There's nothing to question, nothing to really dig into. But if there's some significant differences, then I can dig into it, and that's a big way of helping. Now, for comparison, you could use the New King James, but beware of the footnotes. They sometimes favor the critical text. Now, the New King James was done by Nelson Publishers. And the New King James, if you get a proper copy of it, it has footnotes in it. And the footnotes that they have added, the Nelson Publishers added footnotes, many of them favor the critical text. They'll say the NU. The NU is another reason.
What do you mean critical text?
That's what we talked about before. The Westcott and Hort, the Alexandrian, the critical. Okay. All right. So it's in the New King James, they call it the NU, which stands for, I can't remember now. Peter, do you remember what those stand for? Okay. Two different, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's referring to the critical text. All right. And so they'll put words in there and it says, in the NU it says this. In the NU it says this. So what they're really saying is that we don't really agree with this because the NU says this and the NU is better. All right, so that's one of the problems with the New King James. The text itself is pretty accurate it was translated from the TR, and it's a pretty accurate translation from the TR.
It's easy to read for people who aren't used to this old language.
Yes, I understand that. There's some people that have a lot of big issues with it, but if you really look at what the Greek text says, no. I've looked at all the issues. I've gone down through the whole list of issues that they come up with, and I look at the Greek text and I say, that's what the Greek text says.
I think it stands for Novum Testamentum. According to, I'm looking up a Bible translation, there's an NU Bible translation that stands for Novum Testamentum.
That doesn't ring a bell. There's something else. It's not very complicated. But it just refers to two different groups that were involved in the critical text. But just beware that they use the term NU, and that's what it stands for. All right, now translating the manuscripts, almost finished here. The Alexandrian test Alexander in text has been falsely called the best text since 1881. The English Revised Version of 1885, the American Standard Version of 1901, and the NASV 1971, the NIV 1973, and nearly all other popular Bibles come from this critical text. The New King James in 1982 is an exception. It came from the TR, and it contains footnotes, and I just mentioned those footnotes. Okay, and so the Nestle-Aland. This answers the question. NU stands for Nestle-Aland text and the United Bible Society text, and both of those are critical texts. Okay, so the N comes from the Nelson, and the U comes from the
Nestle-Aland.
No, it's not.
What's that now?
Should be actually Nestle-Aland, not Nelson-Aland. Nestle was the, if I remember correctly, the Hebrew who translated it.
Okay, well, if you find that information, send it off to me. But, the information I've gotten here, unless I did a typo, I don't think I did. So you can check on that.
Yeah, it is Nestle-Aland.
So anyway, you can send me the information if you find it. Okay, many verses and words are left out of the modern translations because they're based on the critical text. Definitions are... deletions are often undermine the Christ's deity. Now, not always, not all the deletions do, but many of them do. They undermine the deity of Christ, and so you got to be real careful about that. It is an issue. All right. Now, summary of the Bible preservation: original Bible manuscripts called the autographs, and making copies of the original manuscripts began during Moses' day. And about 5,500 surviving manuscripts or portions of manuscripts of the New Testament exist. The Byzantine or the majority text, remember the Byzantine and majority are the same thing. All right, so the Byzantine and majority text have about 90% of the supporting manuscripts behind them. And then they were the standard for over 1,800 years. And then the Alexandrian or critical text is based on 10% of the manuscripts and is based primarily on the Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. Stephan's text in 1550 is the Textus Receptus, and the Byzantine text is also there behind the King James and the New King James. And all of the translations are based on the critical Greek text, and many words are left out of the critical Greek text. John Ray.
Remember I said it was the Novum Testamentum?
Yes.
It says there it was compiled by Nestle-Aland. So that is the English.
Okay, thank you. All right. Any thoughts or comments? Well, you did it. Okay. And these things here, you might look at that and think, oh, what's that got to do with us? Well, it actually has a lot to do with us. And the reason I say that, I remember years ago when Melody and I were first married. I think we were married. Might have even been before we were married. I was in a bookstore in America. And a lady came in and she said, I want to buy a Bible. And I'm looking at some other stuff. And the lady's talking to the clerk. And she says, I want to buy a Bible. She says, what do you want? She says, well, I've been looking at this Bible and it says it's a paraphrase. What does that mean, a paraphrase? And you know what the lady told her? The lady told her, oh, that just means it's in paragraph style. And I thought, whoa, don't say that. That's not what it means.
Paraphrase, not paragraph.
No. So, anyway, there's a lot of people that are confused. They don't understand a lot of these things. And so it is important for us to dig into it and look up some of that information.